Hi everyone, here I'm on again with John Richardson, who's I guess are you what do they call you? Are you the legal advisor to the Alliance for the Defense of Canadian Sovereignty? Do you still have a do you have an official title or when you do work with them or how does what is your
Yeah,
current?
I think it's that, but I'm actually yeah, but I think
Okay.
officially I'm the co-chair of the Alliance for the Defense of Canadian Sovereignty and sort of in-house legal advisor.
Okay, so a couple of weeks ago now, I think it was just at the end of January, so it's actually getting close to a month ago, you were out in Vancouver for most of a whole week, I think, and there was finally this constitutional challenge under basically the intergovernmental, that I think most of our listeners know about, but the intergovernmental agreements that have been signed between different countries. In the United States to implement FATCA, that agreement, the agreement that the Canadian government signed, actually under the previous prime minister and now being defended in court by the current prime minister, and I guess now would be former or current attorney general of, which maybe we'll talk to later on in the podcast, but that case finally went to trial, challenging the constitutionality of it. It's been something I think all of us have been waiting for a long time. It was actually, I believe, was this the first trial in the Federal Court of Canada that had been live streamed?
Yes, believe it or not, it was the first of what's anticipated to be, a regular programming of federal court trials.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of special in that regard too.
So I guess maybe just a quick overview from someone who was in the room. How did you feel the trial went? And I'm not, I think you, I guess I'm putting the caveat, you can never quite predict how a judge will rule. But kind of being in the room and actually seeing the whole thing, I probably at best saw an hour or two, maybe three even. What did you, what were kind of your views in terms of the arguments that our council was making and the government council was making?
Right. Well, if you were to go to the link at the, I guess the Isaac Brock Society
Yep.
site, and I believe our site, the
Yep.
adcs.adsc.ca site, you'd find the actual FACMs,
Yep.
meaning the written summary of what the
Yep.
legal arguments are. So, beginning with what our legal arguments are. Basically, this what went on the week of January 28th to the 1st of February was a summary trial based on basically two Charter of Rights arguments, meaning two specific two allegations of two specific sections of the Charter of Rights. One is Section 8, the which is think of it as an unreasonable search and seizure. And the second is Section 15, which is an equality rights, kind of an equal protection type of non-discrimination provision here. The whole point of it being, of course, that the legislation singles out anybody who is a U.S. citizen, whatever that means. And the reason I put it that way, whatever that means, is because it's bad enough singling people out based on citizenship, but the actual agreement allows the United States to define and to redefine the meaning of American citizen.
Relationship.
So, theoretically, all of Canada could wake up one day and learn that they're now deemed to be U.S. citizens for the purposes of information exchange. So, that was the basic argument. Now, this is in the context of the Canadian Charter of Rights, and one of the things that needs to be understood about how the Canadian Charter of Rights works is that there's a you first begin by arguing there's a breach of the Charter right, but there's also a section in the Charter, Section 1, which allows the government to sort of override the Charter of Right. The Charter right, if it can be demonstrably justified that it's necessary in a free and democratic society. The arguments, as you might expect, revolved first around whether there were breaches of charter rights. So, for example, Section 8, there's no warrant required. All it is bulk data transfer based on, a finding that somebody is a U.S. citizen or U.S. person as defined by the United States. And, whereas it would be bad enough if it were bulk data transfer, just for the sake of bulk data transfer, the fact that it's restricted to a very specific group of people based on citizenship, as defined by the United States, which I think is an argument that probably should have been made more forcefully, kicks in the Section 15, the Charter of Rights type of thing. So our lawyers spent basically the first day and a half making out their case, and I think that they did it effectively. Both of them were sort of veteran Charter of Rights lawyers. I mean, certainly Joe Arve is, I think, rightfully acknowledged and considered to be one of the very best Charter of Rights lawyers in Canada. And he did, I think he did a very good job on that. Government, of course, went after them and didn't really, I think, base their case so much on the Charter of Rights or address the Charter of Rights issues. The first day was a summary of the Canada-U.S. Tax Treaty, which, for the life of me, I can't see what it had to do with the issue.
Yeah, I remember listening to some of that, and it just felt like I was drowning on and on and on and on. I didn't watch the whole thing or anything even close to it, but I thought there were moments where the government just seemed to be, like, trying to kill time.
Well, I don't think they were trying to kill time at all. What I think they were trying to do was divert attention from the charter issues.
Yeah.
What I think their basic modus operandi was, well, we may have a charter of rights, but all of this takes place in sort of an international context of information exchange. And, FATCA's no big deal. It's just, another form of information exchange like the CRS. And, I find that argument extremely offensive and objectionable because FATCA is nothing at all like the CRS.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons. Under FATCA, Canada's reporting on Canadian residents and citizens to a country where they don't even live.
Yeah.
Under the CRS, Canada would not be reporting on Canadian citizens or residents. They would be reporting information to a country where the people did live. So, it may appear to be about information exchange, but make no mistake about it. This is for the purpose of trying to identify people who live in other countries that somehow the U.S. can impose worldwide taxation on.
Well, this was one of the things the government did mention, and this is something I've always been nervous about for years. And I remember having this discussion when I was up in Toronto years ago, and I think me and you were sitting in the living room of Stephen Kish, who's the president and CEO of ADCS, on his living room couch. And one of the things they brought up is, well, they actually brought up the savings clause. So they said, well, in every tax treaty Canada has ever had with the United States, we have had the savings clause provision, which gives the rights of, basically says the U.S. can tax its citizens however they want without regard to any provision of the treaty, and that this provision has been in the different treaties Canada signed with the United States for many, many decades. And one of the issues is we technically weren't challenging that. Which I think you could make a Charter of Rights claim, a Section 15 claim on the Savings Clause. I'll note, just for people not familiar, this treaty, the Charter of Rights in Canada was only introduced in 1980 and 1981. So these
82, yeah.
82. So these provisions they're referring to long predate the Charter, and there's been many laws that were, enacted pre 1982 that have been ruled unconstitutional. It's not. It's. You know, it's so I think there's a case, but that wasn't technically what we were arguing. We were arguing against the IGA, and I think they had a lot of good reasons to do that. But I think one issue the government maybe was trying to say, well, I don't know how this would, how, whether they would actually get a ruling saying this, but they were trying to imply, well, it's the tax treaty that's the actual issue that. The IGA is okay legally because in the tax treaty it has the savings clause provision, which is only in the tax treaty between Canada and the US. And maybe there's a similar provision, I think, in the treaty between Canada and the Philippines that's never been taken out, even though the Philippines abandoned citizenship-based taxation many years ago. I believe it's actually still in the agreement between Canada and the Philippines. But it's unique. Canada has something like 90-95 tax treaties. Only the United States really has this provision active within its agreement with Canada. So I don't know how that will factor up in the judge's ruling. I think the tax treaty is just as unconstitutional as the FATCA IGA. The Section 15 discriminatory provisions exist in the treaty too, but that was not technically the argument we were making. Our side was making, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But I did note the government of Canada did bring that point up at some, maybe in the middle of the week, on the savings clause.
But do they bring it up in that way, or do they bring it up, for another reason, or did they not know why they brought it up?
I think I'm not sure they know why they brought it up.
See, this is the part of the problem. The way I experienced listening to the Government of Canada lawyers was that, it was an enormous amount of sort of facts and figures, spewing from their mouths, but, no real roadmap for how to use the information. I do think, though, that they were effective in shifting the focus away from the Charter of Rights. I think that they did two things rather effectively. The first was just the, sheer volume of, talking about technical tax issues and treaties. It made it seem like it wasn't really about a charter case. I think that the constant focus on, well, FATCA is just part of a generalized sea of information exchange, similar to CRS, which is, what I expected them to do, but I think it was reasonably effective. Third thing they did was they worked very, very hard to suggest that the people affected by this were really not Canadian citizens or residents at all. They were just, Americans hiding out in Canada, for the purpose of avoiding U.S. taxes. It was extraordinary how they really did not acknowledge that the people principally affected by this are Canadian citizens and residents. They also, made a number of absolutely preposterous, laughable claims. I don't know how the woman kept from laughing while she was making these arguments about how, the economy of Canada would be destroyed, if
Well,
Canada
that's
did not
one
find a way to
reason why
actively
I wasn't
combat that.
sure they should bring up the tax treaty and the savings clause, because the tax treaty also is supposed, I mean, the main one of the main purposes of the tax treaty isn't even so much the savings clause that specifies maximum rates or withholding on between cross-border income streams. So the argument that, well, we have to comply with FATCA because there's this 30% withholding, but in the treaty it depends on the type of income, but generally there's a maximum of, let's say, 10 or 15% withholding. So and
Yeah, but
seeing.
I'd be really careful with that, Tim, because remember that with FATCA, see, we're talking about the stuff under the treaty. This is on an individual by individual basis, right? Remember that the FATCA withholding is on, at least theoretically, on all sums of money going to a Canadian financial institution. Since you mentioned this, one of the things that I found interesting that the government did was they went into this long, long description of Chapter 3 versus Chapter 4 of the internal. Chapter 3, of course, it has to do with withholding provisions on, for example, U.S. dividends, how much is automatically withheld. And Chapter 4 has to do with the FATCA thing, and I don't see how those things are related at
I don't
all.
see either. And even if you talk from the standpoint of the treaty, the treaty. So basically, I guess the thing I was thinking as well, if essentially they were arguing, well, FATCA, so essentially they're arguing, well, we have this treaty. The treaty allows the United States to impose taxation on these people under the Savings Clause. The treaty also, and the reason we enter into the treaty because it specifies certain rates of withholding on income streams. And the treaty is supposed to trump all other domestic U.S. law. I wasn't sure why they're bringing up Chapter 3 because it's very, from the Canadian standpoint, Chapter 3 really doesn't matter other than a theoretical negotiating basis if there was not a tax treaty in existence. It's the treaty which is the governing document, not Chapter 3. But then they're saying, well, we have to comply with FATCA because of this 30% withholding. Well, then, so they're implying the 30% withholding is a violation of the treaty. Or they didn't say that, but you use that. You mean so it's like we have we acknowledged under the treaty the U.S. has the right to tax its citizens in Canada, but we're accepting under FATCA that the U.S. is violating the treaty, the same document that we have to comply with.
But you know what? Like, this is all incredibly confusing because if we're dealing with U.S. citizens, we're not dealing with a 30% withholding.
Well, it's the 30% withholding on the Canadian financial institutions, which are
Yeah, but
covered by the
I think these are
treaty.
completely unrelated ideas.
Yeah.
The point, I think, is that Chapter 3 has to do with withholding. Not in relation to banks, but in relation to amounts owed to individuals.
Yes.
Chapter 4, the FATCA thing, is just simply a threat. It's not even a withholding. Withholding implies that it's a tentative tax assessment that could somehow be changed if one were to file a return. Chapter 4 is just. In theoretical, it's nothing but a 30% confiscation of the funds going to the Canadian bank, the foreign financial institution. I mean, I was very, very surprised to listen to, the Government of Canada lawyers talk about Chapter 3 and then talk about Chapter 4 as if somehow they were related. I didn't understand their argument at all. And it's impossible for me to believe the judge understood it either. I mean, I would have hated to have been the judge, listening to all this technical garbage going on. But one point that our lawyers brought out that did seem to resonate with the judge was this notion that because the information goes to the Canada Revenue Agency before going to the IRS, apparently the Canada Revenue Agency has acknowledged using that information against the Canadian taxpayers affected.
Yes, I heard. I thought the one hint, and like I said, it's difficult to predict what any judge would rule. And I'll add for the people, who maybe weren't watching this whole thing. I know you've said it, I've said it. The judge actually made quite clear the case will be appealed. That she is under no
Oh yeah,
illusions.
that great line. I'm just a speed bump on, you know. Yeah,
Speed
oh,
bump.
absolutely.
Yeah,
Of course it's going
but
to
the
be
judge
appealed.
did seem to be, I think, concerned of looking more favorably to our side on the so-called Section 8, which is this idea of a warrantless search. And as I told some people, some of that's pragmatic because actually, if CRA wants to get one of these, I call it unnamed persons, they actually have to go to the Federal Court of Canada into the same judge. So, in some sense, the FATCA law is getting around something this judge is actually quite involved with on a day-to-day basis. But she did seem to be really concerned about that, and I'm not really sure the government had a good answer on that. And I have a feeling, I don't want to make predictions, but I have a feeling that that might be, if there's a positive ruling for our side, and again, it'll be appealed no matter what, it'll probably be on the Section 8. That I think, with just all the stuff the judge is being buried under, I think she seemed to really understand the Section 8 issue on the unnamed persons warrantless search. And I think that is kind of, I think if the government loses and our side wins, I'd say the likelihood is highest that will be what it will be on.
Well, I think that it does, you know, sitting in the courtroom and listening to the arguments, it does seem to me that the Section 8 arguments were more easy to absorb. Okay, you know. But don't forget, you know, we've got the whole Section 1 problem, right?
Yes. But my understanding is that what they were saying is that with Section 8 arguments, Section 1 really doesn't come into application. Or basically, if it's an unreasonable search, it's automatically Section 1 doesn't justify it. Or
Right. Yeah, I think that may be the case till now. But remember that, you know, what's that saying? The charter's a living tree sort of thing. You know, the problem with that is, and, you know, maybe you're right, I don't know. The problem with that is that to say that, a violation of Section 8 can never be saved by Section 1. Does, I think, a certain amount of violence to the analytical integrity of the Charter. You know, that specifically says that, you know, that any one of these rights can be overridden by the Section 1 thing. So the question is whether an unreasonable search could ever be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. I'm not as sure. You know, I understand that argument, but I'm not as sure as some people are that that would prevail. But anyway, I think the point for anybody listening to this is that, you know, when you're looking at these charter issues, you know, you got two steps, right? I mean, it's not like the American Bill of Rights where, you know, both the right and the justification is rolled in, you know, to the section itself. You know, there are analytically two steps, and then of course we have the problem of the override altogether.
Notwithstanding, yes.
Yeah.
Which is something that actually does concern me more than most people. And it's actually one reason I tend to support the Justin Trudeau Liberal government at all costs versus the Conservatives because they have made noises about using that more frequently.
Yeah, well, so what that is, you know, for listeners here, is just to, you know, the ultimate sort of charter override where a government can pass a law, put in the preamble of the law that we're going to use this law to override this charter right. And I think it has to be renewed every 5 years or whatever.
Yep.
But you know, Tim, there's a lot of permutations here
Yeah.
in terms of how the decision could go.
Yeah.
You know, you could win on Section 15, lose on Section 1.
But my understanding is if, let's say, the judge would rule in our favor on, like, say, Section 8, she does not necessarily have to deal with the other issues. She can just say, I've analyzed this on the basis of Section 8. It isn't justified under Section 1. Therefore, I rule the law is unconstitutional. And then they would have to go to, she could just say that, and there's no reason to discuss whether it would also be unconstitutional on Section 15. And then it would be later down in the appeals process where they would
you
get
know what?
To the Section 15.
She could do that, but she won't do that.
Okay.
You know, the statement, I'm just a speed bump, you know, to a higher court, you know, I think puts her in a position where she's going to have to respond to this stuff.
Okay.
I mean, I agree with you that, in other words, I think that in this case, because it's clear that it's going to a higher court, I think that there are strong incentives to deal with all the issues.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. It's, you know, it's a very, very interesting problem. You know, a few years ago, was it 2015, when the first round of this was heard?
Yeah.
You know, the tax treaty part of it. I mean, I remember feeling, you know, very optimistic with Justice Martineau.
Yeah.
You know, and then basically, you know, being disappointed by the result. So I have no sense of what the result of this is going to be. But partly I have no sense because I know full well it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
You know, in the sense that it will be going to a higher court. I mean, what I think is important here is the structural integrity of the decision.
Okay.
You know, that it does need to, you know, talk about all these issues so that there is, I mean, how do you appeal, you know, a decision, how do you fully appeal a decision that doesn't talk about all the issues? I mean, let's say you're right that if the judge were to find a violation of Section 8, that would end the whole thing. So then what, you're going to the appellate court on what issues? Just that issue or more issues?
Well, I guess it would be the government would appeal on Section 8, and then whether or not essentially the appellate court would have to decide on Section 8, and then if they decided against, they would have to send it back to deal with Section 15.
Yeah. Well, you know, the trouble with this stuff is that there's no incentive for these things to move quickly.
Yes.
And, you know, the longer this takes,
yeah,
you know, I think the less, you know, the harder the thing is going to be.
Yeah. And that's something that actually does concern me a little bit, because I've let, as people know, I've been discussing this issue with various people in the U.S. political side, both in Washington and both up here in Massachusetts, with some of the local politicians and members of Congress. And I've kind of told them, well, you mean they know about this trial, and that the, you mean, I've kind of told them, I think in honesty that this is going to take a long time, that any ruling has been, will be appealed no matter what. But unfortunately, one downside of that is some of the reason I bring up this trial is to try to put some pressure on the political process. And I think, in some of it, to be fair, and I'm not sure I've ever mentioned on this podcast, I've been given full encouragement to the extent to push ahead with this trial by actual congressional staff members on the U.S. side, which I don't want to get. Anyway, we've discussed this to beat the ban, but I don't buy this thing that somehow people in Washington are offended by us suing the Canadian government over this issue. Maybe some are, but not the people I've thought.
No, I don't think they are. I don't see why they should be, honestly.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I think that
I know
so few of them know anything about it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think it's more that some people and some of the expat organizations in the past have not wanted to, I don't want to get on time about ACA or ARO, but I don't think they were necessarily that thrilled at different points in time with us bringing this lawsuit. I have no idea why.
Oh, who knows? I mean,
I
it
think
really it doesn't make
they're
any
yeah,
difference
no,
whether
it
they
doesn't.
are or not,
It
yeah.
doesn't. And I you mean it's not, and I think that one interesting thing is on the standing question, I think the judge really slapped down the government and basically said, this case has now been active for 3 or 4 years. If they wanted to make the standing case, they should have tried to gone to trial a
Yes,
long
I
time
think that's
ago.
right.
And
I think, I mean, you
standing
can't
issue,
suck and blow
yeah,
at the same time, right?
and standing issues tend to be attorneys that aren't very good, as she put it. She implied basically someone like Joel Harvey doesn't bring a case where the plaintiffs don't have standing. That's something more inexperienced lawyers do. So she didn't. So because our counsel is so experienced, she doesn't seem to be inclined to rule out for against our side on standing. So I thought that was kind of. I mean, the government definitely got shut down on that.
No, but there was the there were two background issues there. There was the standing one, but there was also the jurisdiction of the court one, right? And that was the one that the judge raised in her own initiative. And
And
that
the
was
guy.
kind of interesting because both the lawyers from both sides agreed, okay, took the position that the court did have jurisdiction. I don't. I read that the case that the judge was talking about, and I can understand I understand her perspective.
Yeah, but I thought
But
the case, the issue, as I understand it, roughly was there was a federally regulated company, which certain industries in Canada, like airlines, industries that deal with. I'll actually ex quickly just explain what it was. So most people don't know that the bridge that crosses between Windsor, Ontario, is owned by a private corporation. It's a privately owned toll bridge. I mean, it's the only one. Well, it's the only cross-border one in North America. I'm not. I think it literally might be the only truly privately owned toll road in either the United States or Canada. And the person who owns it is not. I wouldn't say a kind of a semi-disreputable businessman who's had issues with. Municipal zoning safety issues. And Windsor, Ontario, the municipality was challenging him that, he wasn't upkeeping the bridge and doing maintenance the way he should be. And he was basically saying, well, this is international trade, and by definition, I'm not going to go through the Ontario code. Courts. I'm going to sue, counter sue the Win municipality of Windsor, Ontario, and the Federal Court of Canada, and they have jurisdiction because my bridge is international facility. So by definition, it's a Federal Court of Canada issue, not and basically, I believe the Supreme Court of Canada said no. This is local zoning safety code issues, you that can't that isn't within the jurisdiction of the federal court. I guess in parallel on our case, I'd see ours would be almost a completely opposite scenario. Maybe I'm wrong, but I understand what the arguments were in that case. I just it doesn't seem like it's the same arguments in this case. This isn't something being, the laws being applied by the federal government of Canada is not being applied by
Yeah.
a provincial government or municipal, health and safety code.
Well, I think what needs to be understood, for people listening to this podcast, that this particular case, that our charter fact, our FATCA charter lawsuit was brought to Canada's federal courts. Federal courts are courts that are created specifically by statute. The statute lays out, describes exactly what they have the jurisdiction to hear or not hear. And, you know, so the judge was raising a question, does the federal court have the jurisdiction to hear this kind of case? That's all.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously both sides sort of consented on the jurisdiction. You know, on it went.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see. But, you know, the most, absolutely most offensive thing about this, I mean, leaving aside the legalese and all this, is that what this is about, what these IGAs are about, is, you know, countries like Britain and Canada just simply turning their citizens over to the United States.
Yeah. Well, I thought, I mean, I actually, I think the government wasn't completely truthful. I'm not sure I necessarily, I don't know what the reason the government went into this. I think some of it was not just to curry favor with the United States, was to curry favor and not seem too argumentative with other countries who had entered into these agreements before Canada.
But Canada was a leader in this. You know, they were one of the first countries to sign on.
Well, the United Kingdom signed on earlier. There were some countries that signed on earlier.
Even if there were countries that signed on earlier,
Yeah.
there's no question that Canada, was a world leader in the implementation of FATCA.
No, I'd say you're probably correct. Yes.
You know, and
Yes.
that's why, you know, their arguments, the government, Canada's lawyers' arguments that, oh my God, you know, we had to sign this. If we
Yeah.
didn't sign this, it'd be, I mean, how the hell do they know? They were one of the leaders in signing. They were one of the world leaders in FATCA capitulation.
Yeah.
I mean, their arguments are, I mean, they really are laughable.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying they can't win this thing,
Yeah.
but I mean, I think their arguments are really pretty funny.
Yeah. I mean, so some of it, this is kind of my second point, is how much do you think, like, decisions like this, I know you're historically more involved with the criminal law. There's been kind of a real tawdry affair right now where the first attorney general of the Trudeau government has now was moved, reassigned in cabinet, and now to a much more minor position. Now has completely left Canada cabinet, and now we have a new attorney general in Canada as of a month or two ago. And there's been a lot of discussions about where the line of authority on defending litigation and cases. And some of it I find very unimpressive. I get the feeling, I hear a lot of people lately in Canadian politics, and it's something I don't, because I'm afar, and I mean, I don't live like in downtown Toronto where people discuss this stuff a lot, or Ottawa.
Well, they don't discuss it.
Well, the political people do. There seems to be, I always hear this term like rule of law, where we want to be a rule of law society. And I find it kind of like skeptical, because I have a feeling like some of the people who are out there shouting rule of law, are quite supportive of something like FATCA, and would be quite supportive of the government appealing it all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. And I just find there's a lot of hypocrisy on, you know, who's rule of law, who are the favored groups in society, and who's not.
Well, of course. I think that also, you know, the way I sort of think about it sometimes is rule of law versus rule by law.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, rule of law, I think, is a notion that laws should not be arbitrary, laws should be interpreted according to their purpose,
Yeah.
people should have notice of what laws are. And I think that people ought to be able to understand what's expected of them.
Yes.
Rule by laws, I think the opposite.
Yeah.
I mean, rule of law would also suggest that you can't have retroactive laws.
Yes.
You know, rule by law is probably the polar opposite. You
Yeah.
know, retroactivity good. It's a
Yeah.
great thing if people can't understand what's expected of them.
Yeah.
You know, we want a world where everybody's in violation of something. Show me the man, I'll show you the crime.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that the sheer weight of law has evolved to the point where I don't think that people even know what's expected of them most of the time. I think that almost everybody could be convicted of something. I'm not saying something minor or significant, but could be convicted of something. But what I do think is, and this is quite interesting, the idea of talking about rule of law. So rule of law, I think, also implies a separation between governments and the legal process. And what we have going on in Canada right now is a suggestion that there was no separation between governments and legal process because of the allegation that, inappropriate pressure was put on the Attorney General.
I guess this is the issue I have with that, and this is probably like completely, is I have a certain, I guess my experience of dealing with FATCA is that I feel like over the years there's been a lot of deference towards the IRS and the Treasury and kind of the more enforcement, kind of the independent judiciary types, which is that the independence of the judiciary system, which is basically if you complain to someone in the political realm about this, they say, well, there's nothing we can do about it. It's the American judicial system. As a Canadian elected member of parliament, we have no control over these policies.
I think that is total, total garbage.
Yes.
One of the things that strikes me about this is that, there's a lot of this, I'm very interested in citizenship law.
Yeah.
And, if we go back to the League of Nations in World War I.
Yeah.
The whole purpose of that was basically, countries are free to define, who their citizens are, this sort of stuff. Well, I think that there may be some truth to that, but that does not mean necessarily that, a country's definition of who its citizens are should apply outside the country.
Yes.
I don't think there's a reason in the world why Canada should accept the U.S. definition of who's a U.S. citizen for people who are in Canada.
Yeah.
What was it, 2014, I think it was a witness for the House Finance Committee on this, and I made the point then, I'll make the point now.
Yeah.
So I don't care, how this stuff is actually defined.
Yeah.
The point is that how it cannot be defined, what it cannot mean is this. That, that basically the U.S. cannot impose tax laws on Canadian citizens who are resident in Canada, or cannot define Canadian citizens' residence in Canada as U.S. citizens, for the purpose of anything that's going on in Canada.
But
it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, but this is like, doesn't this go back to like these old legal, 17th century legal concepts like comity and reciprocity and recognize one country recognizing the other country's laws as they exist?
Well, I think it's perfectly fine to recognize what the U.S. law of citizenship is. I think that Canada ought to do that.
Yeah.
But they shouldn't apply it to Canadian citizens and residents in Canada.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah.
I think it's the simplest thing. I get that that's your definition of a U.S. citizen. As a sovereign country, you're entitled to do that. But the problem is this, that, these are also Canadian citizens who are resident in Canada. And, although we respect your right to define who's a U.S. citizen when they're in your jurisdiction, when they're in our jurisdiction, we're not going to accept that definition.
Yeah.
That's, I think, the right approach here.
Yeah. I guess this is, like I said, this is, I tend to mistrust. I think from watching the trial, I have much more respect for lawyers who actually practice law and try cases, and much less respect for like law professors and just people who teach law, in ivory tower, atmospheres. And I guess that's some of this whole, like I said, I I mean, it bought, and I think this is going to be an issue, especially with accidental Americans, because I think what they really want is like a full amnesty, and they're probably right to get it. But you run into this thing as well. That's interfering with the IRS's enforcement, independent judicial enforcement powers that you're going to have
Well,
elected.
yeah, I was talking to a couple of people about that yesterday, and my thinking on that is that, when the accidentals talk about an amnesty, it's as though they're saying, well, okay, so maybe we're U.S. citizens, but, our ties are so tenuous to the United States that, we should have an amnesty. I think the better thing, or at least what they should do equally, is say, nope, sorry, we're not U.S. citizens for this purpose. Never were intended to be. So we're not asking for an amnesty. We're actually not asking for anything. We're just not U.S. citizens.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, and I've told them that specifically. I don't know why. You mean, and that's in. You mean that's yeah. Yeah, I tend to agree with your position on that.
I mean, look at it this way. There's a discussion going on right now in the U.S., and this is, and scholarly opinion on this is divided. On the issue of, whether children born to parents who are neither permanent residents nor citizens should have a claim to U.S. citizenship. And, this all starts, of course, with the 14th Amendment. And that's, everybody born in the U.S. is a U.S. citizen, but you've got the word subject to the jurisdiction. And, there is a body of, I think, responsible legal opinion that the word subject to the jurisdiction would mean that, these so-called anchor babies, meaning babies who are born to neither permanent residents nor citizens, should not have a constitutional right to citizenship. The Immigration Nationality Act, it seems to me, really is just trying to follow the constitutional definition. I don't think it's trying to give for people born in the United States more rights than are given by the Constitution. But, you see, part of the problem here is that we're not even talking about rights to citizenship here. We are actually talking about what is clearly the forced imposition of citizenship on people. And like I think this, and I must acknowledge that I'm in an extreme minority view of this. Almost everybody disagrees with me. However, I've thought about this for so long that I think, I'm sorry everybody disagrees, but I think I'm right. I do not believe that the United States can forcibly impose citizenship on people born outside the United States.
Oh, I don't wouldn't believe that myself. I'm surprised there's a lot of other people that disagree with you.
Oh, almost everybody disagrees with me. You see, what they do is they read the Immigration Nationality says, oh, anybody born outside the United States to two U.S. citizen parents is a U.S. citizen. But see, the problem is, but first of all, the Immigration Nationality Act is, comes from the early 50s, at a time when everybody in the world wanted to be a U.S. citizen. So, if the assumption of the statute is that everybody in the world wants to be a U.S. citizen, and you say, well, anybody born to two U.S. citizen parents is a U.S. citizen or shall be a U.S. citizen. Why should that not be interpreted to be, well, we are going to allow you to be a citizen because everybody in the world wants to be a citizen. You've won the jackpot today, buddy. We're going to let you be a U.S. citizen. The statute was never contemplated that people would not want to be citizens. So I think it's very, very difficult to for the accidentals to fight this on the basis of some kind of a tax amnesty. Because to ask for an amnesty, you have to agree you're a citizen. And that's precisely what they should not be doing.
Well, I think the issue, well, I agree with that. I think the problem is they see that the holding legislation doesn't do anything for them. And they're
Well, of
right.
course it doesn't,
Yeah.
because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't.
Yeah,
The
I know.
problem with the holding legislation is that it does not, it's not RBT. It does not relinquish U.S. jurisdiction over people. It just says we'll keep the CBT, but we'll change the type of income that's taxable. And of course, that's going to be offensive to people who don't, you know, regard themselves as U.S. citizens. But, you know, as I say, I mean, the more that, you know, I think this really hit me yesterday when I was in this long conversation, is that, you know, I mean, you know, these people, they are not citizens in any meaningful sense. They're only a citizen if the U.S. has a right to forcibly impose citizenship on people. And that turns U.S. citizenship into some form, kind of a form of slavery. And we would all agree that U.S. citizenship is not and was never intended to be a form of slavery. Therefore, there has to be some sort of consensual element in it, you know, for people who have no connection to the United States. I mean, look, if the Supreme Court of the United States in Aforium and later in Vance versus Terrasses in 1980 had not struck down, you know, various provisions of the, you know, the expatriation provisions of the Immigration Nationality Act, I guarantee you, you know, the United States would be stripping people of citizenship left, right, and center, right? So we wouldn't even have this problem.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess the thing I brought up, and this is something I'm going to have to think about, but this is what's really turning me against. I don't want to use Michael Kirsch as the name again, but people kind of come up. One thing, I was just out of curiosity after I traveled to Washington. I was curious what, like, the academic literature, what people thought, especially on kind of the more activist left, about the right of people like myself to petition elected officials. And I was actually surprised that there's quite a bit of papers and stuff written that people shouldn't have the right to talk to their local members of parliament or their local members of Congress, which I know you're going to be stunned in silence at, but basically the argument was, and this is what goes back to what's going on in Canada, that by allowing people to petition their elected officials, they will encourage their elected officials to interfere improperly in the execution of the judiciary and government.
Right. Well, that of course is, you know, quite laughable. If
Yeah.
anything, you know, the rise of the political party you know, means that, you know, people have no access to their elected representatives anyway.
But this is actually the argument. This is why I said I have newfound respect for people who actually practice law versus those who are just kind of academic, political science, and legal professors. The argument is that by definition, political parties are more democratic. That, like, not everyone has the time or resources to talk to their elected officials to directly petition as an individual. Whereas political parties represent a much broader coalition of people.
Well,
And
yeah,
I
I
guess
don't
I, when I read some of this stuff, I was like stunned, and I was saying, like, this is what we're up against. This type of thinking that
Well,
people are.
we are up against a problem where what we don't have anymore is sort of a town hall kind of democracy where people can be heard.
Yes.
You know, that's really the problem here. And it's much more of a problem in the United States than I think any other country in the world because it's only a two-party system.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, and you know, You mean to be fair, like some of the, you mean like my local congressman does a lot of town halls, and I tend to go to all of them, and they're all relatively close to where I am, and that's some of the reason I've gotten to know his staff people, and they kind of recognize who I am. But I think that is a problem. I guess I'm thinking more back to as we continue to go through this litigation, is how do we make the political process work for us, and trying to get around the barriers and some of the divides. And I think it's still very tough sledding. I don't really have a quick and simple answer to how to achieve these things.
Very difficult. Very, very difficult. I mean, in Canada, the individual MPs don't even have any meaning anymore. You know, completely, subject to the rules of party discipline and, the party whips and this sort of stuff. I mean, it's tough. It is really, really tough. For different reasons, I think, in Canada and the United States. But very, very hard.
Yeah, and I think, you mean, I actually think what's weird, like, about this latest case, this SNC-Lavalin, is I actually think, I haven't followed this that closely, but I followed a couple of sources I thought might have some interesting perspectives, some of the newspapers in Quebec. And what's interesting is if there's a of the political parties that actually has what I would call a very consistent issue, is the Bloc Québécois, which is basically opposition is to order the Public Prosecution Service not to prosecute this company. End of story. Whereas the, you mean, and that, you mean, you can argue, we can talk about rule of law and stuff like that, but that is a very clear position. And, in the, but the problem is the other three parties are trying to play games. You mean, they're trying to say, well, we didn't order, if we were in government, we wouldn't order the prosecutors to go easy, but we would encourage them to go easy. And what is the definition of encourage versus order, informal pressure versus formal? I think you get these coalitions. I think some of the, I think in a weird way, when you get small, and I'm not making this as an argument for like Quebec becoming an independent country, I do think there is something telling that when you get smaller parties, they can some, I think some of the problem with our political system is everyone still tries to be all things to all people. And I think I've, and the reason I come up with, I bring up that scenario is because, like, what's happening, I think, in the US is still there's a lot of, in the US, two parties there, there's still people, you mean, trying to be all things to all people there. I think we, as overseas Americans and accidental Americans, we've had an impact on bringing this issue to the floor on both parties. But there's still elements of both parties that are totally opposed to us, and both parties are trying to play the game of, well, telling us, yeah, the holding legislation. You mean, I think they're still trying to play both sides. So the second thing too, and this is probably going to be another topic, is I find it interesting. Several people brought up to me that Kamala Harris, was actually lived in Canada for several years, and she's now one of the leading presidential candidates. And there's actually been some people suggesting, asking my opinion on what the impact of that might be, which I have some interesting
Yeah,
thoughts
I'll tell
on.
you what, why don't we, we've been going for a while, why don't we make that a separate talk in the
Yeah,
next
no, we
few days or
should. That will
something?
be like the next topic.
Yeah, that sounds great.
So let's wrap things up for tonight, and we'll talk again later.
All right.